This is tape two of Ralph Ellison, February 25th. A moment ago, Ralph, you said that Dr. Clark made his remark about Martin Luther King's philosophy as a non-Southern Negro. Would you talk about that a little bit, please?
Yes, well, I think that we have to recognize that Negro experience is determined by the region in which it takes place. You cannot then make general statements unless you are pretty close to the background out of which a man like King comes. Not only is there the religious discipline behind it, but the whole idea of sacrifice, of leadership. And this gets into the what I call discipline of how a man grows up, what he learns from how he grows up, what stances he takes from the pressures which are applied against him, how does he contain fear, how does he contain provocation, how does he contain his own emotions, his anger and so on. How does he relate this to a general situation? And Negroes who grow up in the South have to be much closer to this necessity than those who grew up in the South, where for many, many years there was a false sense of freedom. And I don't mean to detract from the kind of freedom which does exist in the North.
Sure, sure.
But now, during this period, it seems to me no accident that the leaders are coming from the South.
This is a very strange fact, though, at first glance, and remains a strange fact at the fifth glance, the tenth glance, a good many people. Yes. How would you explain this this fact? Let me interrupt a second. Mm-hmm. Ordinarily, it's said that revolutions are made by cramp, not oppression. Mm. In the North, you had cramp rather than oppression. Mm. In the classic Southern situation, you had oppression. Or was it a question of oppression gradually turning into cramp in the South, or shading into cramp in certain quarters?
Well,
how would we argue this?
It's a very difficult question to get at, but I think this has to be taken into account. Is that there is a Negro way of life in the South, and that the pressure is applied at certain points. Beyond those points, we were able to make up a life for ourselves, and this life was enough to sustain morale. This is why we weren't destroyed. This is why we didn't go to pieces. If you want to get a real good look at the quality of Negro life in the South, you go to a graduation exercise at a Negro school and look at the parents. Just look at them. Just look at them. Just I remember in the 50s, how struck I was to see this at Tuskegee. To see the semi-ignorant parents who had been saving the nickels and dimes to get those kids to college. Now this is a much more complex man than woman. Much more dedicated than appears from the outside. From the outside, we look at it through the categories of sociology and politics, and we see only that. You see the alienation, you see the the oppression. But it depends upon where you sit. If you're living within certain sharply defined confines, you learn how to live within that. And if your values set your eyes upon hills which lie in the distance, you are determined. I mean, your actions, your character is determined by those values, which you are exercising despite the social and political pressures.
There's those who got annealed, those who got tempered by this, were really tempered.
They were really tempered. Yes.
That's your what I'm saying. For this incredible burst of this leadership.
Yes.
That has emerged.
I think so, and remember, we don't always scrutinize a Negro. I grew up in Oklahoma. Now, I grew up around people who had walked in a group from Gallatin, Tennessee, to the Oklahoma Territory. The old man who's my foster, I call it my foster grandfather. I was born in his house. My parents were young and they were living in his rooming house. And, well, he was very important to me. He was one of the first teachers out that way. But their sense of courage was unmistakable. Texas law was imposed on the new state of Oklahoma, and they fought it. They fought it with axe handles, and there were whites who fought along with them. And the struggle for many, many years was to keep the law from becoming too sharply imposed. I'm talking of segregationist law.
Yes.
Upon the Negro community. And this involved shootings. It involved the whole business. Now, perhaps it took more courage to remain in the South, especially in the Deep South, because Oklahoma is full of Negroes from Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia, not to mention the Carolinas.
Yes.
Perhaps those who stayed were tempered even more. And one of the things which we have to take into account is a sense of timing.
Now, how do you mean that, Ralph?
Again, very much as I mean what I meant when I mentioned the individual having to decide when his life should be.
I see.
So, so much of the activity that we are reacting to today was released by the Supreme Court decision, which meant that there were people all along there, all the time, who were waiting for. Now we can move. We have a foothold.
Let me ask a question in relation to that, having to do with the history of the last 50 years, 40 years. Let's go back to the 30s. Negro grievances were as great or greater. There was a social crisis. There were attempts to involve the Negro in this social crisis by various white groups. Why didn't a Negro movement, a Negro revolt, appear then rather than 25 years later, shall we say?
A paradox. The national crisis was a reason for optimism on the part of the Negro.
as the Negro moves in, takes a step at a moment of national crisis always, that it's tied to the rhythm of national crisis.
It has been so tied, and in this sense, what happened was that when the WPA and such movements got going, for the first time, many Negroes who were who would have been the leaders, say, of the revolt, found ways of functioning in the larger society. All those Negroes who had been hopefully taking courses in business and so on went right into the WPA and went on from there in the war industries, and they found a place in the society. So it was a moment of optimism for us. Although we were struck badly, but for instance, I became a writer because I could work for the WPA, do research, and learn to practice my craft.
That's an interesting fact. I've heard you say this before, but I've never sort of tied this in the whole picture. Tell me this: was there enough prepared, educated leadership in the 30s? To do this enormously complicated job of organization, which has occurred among Negroes in the last, say, 10, 15 years, 10 years particularly?
There might have been, but I don't think that there was the knowledge. We have to...
I mean trained leadership. I don't mean will, but trained leadership.
Trained for that kind of organization?
It can be used for that, you see. This is a vast feat of organization in a very short time.
Yes, but I don't think it was possible. I doubt if there were many whites who could have helped that many years ago. But what we have to recognize is that one of the things which Negroes learned from the agitational techniques of left-wing groups and so on during the 30s was how to do this. This is learning from others, and what else, the other thing which is necessary is a certain amount of disenchantment on the part of younger Negroes. You know, when you really live this way. When you live a segregated life, you discover one thing, as I discovered a long time ago, is that Shakespeare reads just as good in Harlem as he does on Sutton Place. I had a letter from a friend down in Maryland, in Baltimore, who said that, you know, it's hard to get people to understand that there are Negroes who live in the South who don't feel segregated, but who are involved in this because they just want to be able to go anywhere they want to. That their lives are so organized that they live, I assure you, they live richer lives than many, many of my friends who live in New York.
Well, let's assume that to be true, sure.
It is true,
and your feeling.
That's right. Well, you are closer to it, but there are people who don't believe it, and they can't understand that human beings build their nest as they have to build it, and at a certain point, many Negroes could be satisfied living their own particular lives, but now something else has happened. Through the wars, through the general unrest of the world, the younger ones feel pretty desperate about it. They aren't entering, through the broader American society as rapidly as they feel they should.
A man I talked to a week or two ago, he was a very able attorney and a graduate of a good Northern University and law school, living in the South, said to me, I'm content with the way I live. I live a segregated life. You look at it from the outside.
Yes.
He said, the drunk's on the corner and the house down the street's falling down. He said, I wouldn't change my way now. I'm middle to it. I wouldn't change my way of life. I'm happy. I'm functioning as I like to function. But he said, I want my son to have other options.
Yes.
Is that?
That's right.
But of course, as a paraphrase of what?
This is a paraphrase. This is one of the paraphrases. And this explains why certain types of action did not occur earlier. That's one of the factors. Here, there is the recognition that the violence, this is important, the violence used to be arbitrary and it was for nothing. Now, if you, someone in the Air Force told me, said, well, one charge that no officer wants is discrimination. Nobody in the American Armed Forces wants a Negro to bring a charge, a right as congressman, say, I am being discriminated against in the armed forces. He said, because the brass, the Pentagon doesn't want that. He said, he can't keep his nose clean. That's one of the quickest ways not to get anywhere in the armed services. And the young kids, the young Negroes have discovered, said, well, if we go out here now and somebody sticks a dog on us, it's going to make headlines and somebody's going to suffer from this. It's worth getting bitten to have the spotlight put on Bull Connor.
To start the dominoes falling down the line.
That's right. Here again is the idea of sacrifice.
That is, the older pattern of life was the unendurable moment that a man's lashed out, is that it?
Sure.
And now it's a calculated, the non-violence has many of these, as the calculation of a tactic.
It is, it's a tactic.
Plus these other ones you're talking about.
Yes, I think so. You could psychoanalyze it and so on all you want to, but this can be an aggressive act, and indeed it is an aggressive act. And a man who is in the position of sustaining blows for a cause is not sustaining psychic injury. He might be getting his head blooded.
You mean that contradicts what Dr. Clark said?
I think so.
Something else in that line, may I ask? As a psychological datum, would it seem that the fact that Dr. King walk into a crowd ready to explode into a bloodlust in Birmingham and draw it out in a minute. Isn't that a psychological datum too?
I think so. I think so. And I think this, when you listen to Martin Luther King talk, you feel a great reserve of power. Now you can have some.
You've heard it.
This is power, and he knows it. He knows that he can have Negroes. He is one man who can have Negroes throwing themselves under airplanes, blocking buses and things. If this is what he wanted to do, and the very sense of this power is felt by the people who respond to it.
So it's not a matter of weakness. It's a matter of participating in power.
I think so. This is a very powerful figure.
Clearly. Let me change the subject a little bit, Ralph. Mm-hmm. A little bit, Ralph, again. You said a moment ago, you referred a moment ago, this incredible devotion to the prospect of education. People who made vast sacrifices for their children's faith in education. Now this, relates to an article I read some months ago in Harper's Magazine. It's written by a woman whose name is spelled G-I-B-E-L. She is white. European born, came as a refugee as a young girl in the 30s. She's married to a Negro in New York. She has two children. She said her feeling was the busing system attempted to integrate schools by arbitrary busing around was doomed to fail. that he was unrealistic and was took a kind of mechanical orthodoxy of civil rights. But the need was schools primarily. This is never can never work anyway because it just won't work, can't work.
Mm-hmm.
The need was education, schools. The real issue, concealed issue, was to really get good schools and do the best you can with these other.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense?
Well,
she's in a special position. She is the white woman married to an American Negro with children in schools now.
Yeah. Well, I can appreciate her point of view, but I'm not so certain of. Well, let me first agree that the main issue is to get the schools, and I'm not going to be put in the position of implying even that the only way that Negroes can get good education is to be in classrooms with whites. That isn't the problem. That is not the problem. But I do think this, that there are a part of this, the education of the white kid is to see Negro neighborhoods, to get a feel of it. This is the advantage which white Southerners have over Northerners. They know a little bit more about Negroes.
At least they know how they live.
They know how they live, yes.
Street, anyway.
That's right. This is not true here. And I'm not going to be put in the position of saying that there's something which is going to destroy that white kid if he takes a bus into a Negro neighborhood. I can't.
Is that the question? I just explore this a little bit together.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the question? Suppose a person should say to you, a white person, who is living, far, far away from concentration of Negroes, you see.
Mm-hmm.
If the neighborhood changes, anybody that comes to this school is welcome.
Mm-hmm.
And this question you can believe, let's assume you believe this speaker. But it's an hour and a half or 2 hours out of the day of an 8-year-old child being bused over there and bus back. This is a big sacrifice.
In what terms?
The 2 hours on a bus for a child of 6, 7, 8, 9. It's done over now. It's a big sacrifice. Out of there, the day of their day.
Well, what happens in the country?
It happens in the country. Where it happens sometimes. Yes, it does indeed. It
happens.
Should one choose it, you see? Now, if this person making this objection, this is not a, let's believe this speaker.
Yeah.
It's a hypothetical speaker. Who would say, I don't care. Anybody at this school is open to anybody. My money, I would like to have, but I'll take the individual little Johnny, and I want him to do travel only half an hour a day instead of 2 hours.
Yeah.
This argument, you see, which one doesn't count.
Yes, you encounter the argument, and from their point of view, it's valid. I can believe that, and this should be the right of people to have that kind of decision over their children. Other than that, I think of the fact when my mother was working in a white middle class neighborhood, 17th class in Boulevard in Oklahoma City. I used to have to start out around 6 o'clock to walk to school. Part of my education was gained walking to school.
Well, that's true of a lot of people now alive in this country that it was true.
And I didn't think of it as a sacrifice. The other thing I would say, Red, is that the busing idea is an improvisation, isn't it? Is it conceived as a permanent device?
I don't know. See, I'm asking this question. When you are, what are you going to do in Washington, D.C.? You see, as when you get a case of enormous concentration of Negro population, busing unless you go to West Virginia for the kids.
No, you're not going to do it. You're not going to do it. And of course, this is where I have to agree with the lady whom you quoted. The real problem is schools, the quality of education.
And behind that, the question of the de facto segregation itself.
Yes.
But now, how do you attack this? You see, I'm not asking any man to say, five minutes of solution to this. But it's a question of where you put emphases so we don't have a shibboleth out of it.
Now, I honestly
don't have a permanent committed view myself on this question. My first reaction is to make this clear.
Mm-hmm.
But I would welcome someone coming here to school with my child. Well,
sure.
I would say that 2 hours is too much. I would not have it just on grounds of prudence for the child.
Well,
but I wanted to have experience, obviously,
sure,
of a mixed society in his classroom. But I would not take 2 hours out of his life,
five
days a week to get it. The Princeton plan does something. It says it switches back and forth.
Yes,
it makes it cut both ways. You see,
that's
so
right.
Neither party is
making
it. And the distance is not so great, the Princeton plan. They're limited.
Right. It's a small school.
But it's forced into vast distances, and it's another matter. Half an hour or even 45 minutes is one thing. Two hours is another.
Yeah.
I just wanted to raise this question and see if you had any immediate
response.
I have no
immediate responses. Where there are real, where there are real objections, which are not based upon fear of the Negro child, fear of...
Sort them out.
That's right.
You don't know who's lying.
It all gets mixed together. I do know this, that one of the obligations of being an American, it seems to me, is that you get to know other Americans. And one of the necessities is that we should not be afraid of others. How that's going to be broken down, I don't know. It's going to take time, and it won't happen in time unless we keep the pressure up. Now, what the solution to this school problem is, I don't know.
I've heard one or two Negroes say that the busing is truly a tactical device in the mind of some leaders.
Well, it's quite possible.
We make this an issue to dramatize the situation. Now these people are not in a position to know the minds of the leadership. You see, they are intelligent people who are intelligent, observing, widely reading people, but they are guessing.
Mm-hmm.
Others say that at least some of the leadership means to bust the whole city around New York.
I tell you this, though, and this should be taken into consideration. I said it earlier, the demand that the sacrifices be shared is quite real. And there is a mood which has been reinforced by the experience with the FEPC. When the first march on Washington was threatened.
You mean back in 41?
Yes. There was this, all the glamour went up. Said, well, are you going to embarrass your country in time of war? And the answer, of course, the country has been embarrassing me all this time. And if you let me get into jobs, I will help with the war effort. The feeling of vindictiveness on this level, if the country is not going to function, then it's not going to function. If holding on to certain arrangements is so precious to others that they would let the country come to pieces, then we are not in the position to stave off this eventuality.
The question is what is practical, you see, and for the benefit of all, the question is behind. behind this, and I don't have any kind of sale.
I watch the cities drifting. For instance, this is a fairly decent apartment. It has a good view. It isn't fashionable anymore. But certain things don't happen here. That is, certain things do not happen on the streets.
Such as?
The upkeep of the drive, in this section at least, is not what it should be.
You mean the city,
the parking lot, and so on. And yet, I am inheriting something which is very good for me. Actually, I don't care about people leaving the city. I would hope that certain people would be available because I like to see them. I like to talk with them. But if the Negroes are going to inherit the city, it should also be noticed that we're going to exercise more and more political power.
Well, that's so obvious.
Yes.
That's why they give you all the voters in the city.
That's right. This is what happens. And if they ever give Washington self-rule, you're going to see some tremendous changes there.
That's clear enough. What's all you buy? What do you want to talk about?
Oh, I don't know, Red. The irony of American history is such that we're always trying to discover ourselves. And maybe the hopeful thing about this is that we are being forced to consciousness and conscience again, because this is the most hopeful aspect of it. I'm worried to some extent about my own group, the own movement, because I get the feeling that there is not a sufficient awareness of the larger culture on the part of many of the leaders. I don't know whether you found this to be true in talking with them.
I don't know. I just don't know. Well, I can generalize about that. It's a question: what is a tactical gain as opposed to what is strategic gain, I suppose, and it's hard to assess that. Back to the bus again. Is it thought of as a total and moral solution, or is it thought of as a piece of vengeance, or is it thought of as a tactical device?
Yes.
See, and of course, you can't say it's who's doing the thinking too. Million people involved, So we don't know where how to isolate a question like that. There are some people you're pretty confident of thinking in long range, generally social terms. There are some people who should be nameless, who I think are not thinking that way. They're humanly trapped in power urges and vengeances and things like that. But is it so far as I can make out, the main leadership has had some social vision.
Yes.
If that passes, it's going to be rough.
Yes, it certainly will, because we do have I think we have inherited a certain obligation to the nation. This is again one of those crazy paradoxes where we have, to an extent, had to force certain issues, the moral issues, and I should hope that as we move further and further into the broader range of things in the society, that we will be as careful about the values that we embrace as we are now being about the strategies which we try to work out to bring about integration. If that's lost, I mean, if Negroes simply embrace these deadly values which are so prevalent in the United States, then I think the nation is in very bad shape.
Well, some will embrace those values.
Yes, some will. Some will. It's inevitable. But I'm hoping that process of rejection, and there's a great deal of rejection which takes place among Negroes. This isn't recognized often, not because it's felt that you do things in reaction to what's done to you. You're reacting to segregation, to anti-Negro feelings. But this isn't the whole picture. There are just some things which Negroes do not like.
Arnold Rose says that the problem who proposed the terms of the social conflict, the minority group or the majority group. And though he says the majority group by and large proposes the terms of the social conflict, there's an area which the minority group can control. Well now, is this true, as it seemed to be, that the Negro is discovering ways now to oppose the terms of the issue?
Yes. And the beauty of it is that he is proposing the terms out of the Constitution.
Yes, the moral and legal terms he is proposing rather than the trial of force.
It's practical to do so, and the more telling weapon, the more effective weapon, if you maybe speak of it in these terms.
Why not?
Lies precisely in those documents which were forged to get the whole country going. To that extent, they're still quite valid, and they're still the last best hope for man. People create themselves in this country. The Negro has been creating himself. This is very hard for some people to grasp. You take a little of this.
So is a white man.
That's right. This is what's been going on. I was telling the kids this morning how I used to be puzzled by the fact that in Oklahoma City, so many of the Negro leaders, the pioneers, were named after Southern generals. This was a real problem until I realized it has reached in and abstracted certain qualities.
One question, people sometimes react with horror to thought by Thomas Jefferson, the author of one of these muniments of our national identity and so forth, held slaves.
Yeah.
Just for record, how do you respond to that fact?
I respond to the fact that people aren't always able to do to put into practice what they actually believe. They find it expedient to do certain things which actually go against their ideals, or they think that they can postpone postpone acting on the basis of these values.
Or history may propose the terms that they can't deal with.
That's right.
It's like winter and racism.
Yes, exactly.
That irony of the Lincoln Memorial and the March on Washington.
That's right.
If you might expect to call that an irony.
That other thing that they which always amuses me whenever I drive on the outer drive in Chicago. I see Senator Douglas up on his pedestal there near the lake, and he's up to his ass in Negroes now. The history keeps backlashing. But you're quite right about that pointedness of that march, culminating at that particular point after all these years.
Something had happened. Lincoln's role and Lincoln's beliefs are no longer acceptable. Mm-hmm. Lincoln's just talk of role, this is a complicated fact.
Really turns around on you. Man can't, he can affect history, but I don't think he can control it. I don't think he can really make it. There are too many things which jump up and hit you in the face.
He can't make his past history anyway.
That's right. And we've tried to do it too often.
Well, I'll have to ask you what our time situation is.
Well,
it's 10 after 6, the train is 125th Street. 30 minutes.
Well, that's easy.
Well, you tell me when we should knock
off. Okay.
There's a question around that. We all tend to think in present, our present, of absolutes of morality and absolutes of all sorts of values. Yeah. Along this and along that. We all know that things exist in time and all life is processed. This raises a question about such a slogan as freedom now, its various levels of interpretation.
That's awesome.
Now you see 1,000 possibilities. I'd just like to hear you chat about that a moment.
Well, I picked up a magazine. Someone sent me a magazine the other day, and there were photographs of kids carrying placards saying, freedom now or the fire next time. Well, this is unrealistic in those terms. I as to the slogan "Freedom Now," it is a like all slogans, a the projection of an ideal and a call to effort rather than. The expectation that things are going to happen immediately. But I think it also serves notice that the pressure must be continuing. I think that's the main thing, and I think it's very often, as with most slogans, the slogan is addressed to Negroes as much as it is to whites.
Oh, sure. I assume that. I was thinking of the varying interpretations of this slogan that you encountered in my experience. Like a very intelligent lad, you see, college kid, 20 years old, talking about this topic of history of time. Discussion of our social process, and no absolute and no immediate change. And then he said, but I can't bring myself to say it. So he stopped himself. That's the drama.
The sense of the awareness of history has moved very slowly. But also the element of desperation which is involved, and certainly the pressure, the sense of life getting away.
Whitehead's remarks about the changed time sense after the Industrial Revolution and it being constantly accelerated anyway has some bearing on this, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
Some little bearing,
constriction of time as imposed by television, such these kind of things, and the rise in Negro literacy, this makes it speed up. This accelerates it.
And that's going to keep on snowballing.
That's right. This is not going to stop.
Well, Frederick Douglass is right when learn your alphabet.
You're on the way. But I work, have been serving on a committee studying this dropout, and this is one of our big problems.
Those are your Washington trips.
That's right. And what lies behind it is not simple discrimination, so on. Very often, it's the ignorance of the teacher who does not know how to contact that Negro in terms of his own cultural background. In fact, the assumption is that he has no cultural background. I'll send you my Library of Congress speech.
May I have? Yes. Okay. All right, fine.
It hasn't come yet, but I'll send it.
Well, will you do that?
Sure.
I'm getting a little noisy. Maybe I better. This is the end of Take 2, Ralph Ellison, February 25.
There will be no more on this tape. There will be no more on this tape. End this tape. There will be no more on this tape.